Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Welcome back to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series, coming out of the Chiang Mai studios of Shambles Guru. And this is the third in a trilogy. Hope you've been following this over the past couple of weeks. We're hoping to come to some sort of conclusion at the end of this. I hope some way we can bring the story to fruition. I'm with, if you haven't been following it, I'm with Dr. Stephen Whitehead again, as I've been for the last 29 episodes, and as with in the last two episodes, I'm with Ali again.
Hi.
Hello.
Nice to be here again.
And I think it might help, especially if you've not listened to the last two podcasts, Stephen, if you could do your elevator 3-minute summary of how we've got to where we are at the moment.
Well, yeah, thanks, Chris. The first podcast, it was basically introducing Ali Taylor and something about her life. The second podcast, we've got a title which was Boy to Woman, and that podcast was detailed in quite interestingly how Ali went, the various processes and stages that Ali went through, from being Alan, born as a male, to being Ali, the woman that's now sat with us here at the Shambles studios. We've explored the process of change from Alan Taylor to Ali Taylor, now 55, living in Chiang Mai with her girlfriend, the Thai lady Tuk. We've explored that. So now in this podcast, what we want to look at is being Ali, being the woman. Apologies to the sensitive readers, a bit of an emphasis on the sexuality, though with some boundaries. So Ali, you are now, in every respect imaginable, legally, physically, in your head, disposed of the maleness, the man, not disposed of the masculine, because the masculine is in all of us, male and female, but you are now a woman and in a intimate relationship with another woman. Tell us a bit about how that came about here in Thailand.
When I came into Thailand in 2002 for the operation, it'd been the first time I'd been to Asia, the first time into Thailand. And throughout the time in the hospital and in the month thereafter, you could experience this difference of attitude by people toward each other. Not just to me, but toward each other, that there was a freeness. You'd walk into any store along any road, and you would see there being a different relationship between people. And one of the things you feel as a person coming here for their operation is a sense of, you know, I've been reborn. Not just because of what you've gone through, but you've actually realised that this was the environment that you've missed all the way through your life.
You're talking about Thailand now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I came to Chonburi and spent a month there and witnessed those early feelings about Thailand. And I kept coming back for holidays thereafter and feeling that I want to go to Thailand. I am going to go to Thailand to live. I am not going to retire in England. I'm going to leave this country and I want to go to Thailand to live. And I saturated myself with as much Thai-ness as possible. And I started reading the language books. I started visiting the temple in Wimbledon. Started eating Thai twice, three times a week, various restaurants, trying to understand what it was about Thailand and its culture that made me feel the way it did, and maybe I could appreciate some of it while in England. I couldn't. You have to come here. And when I came holiday after holiday, I found that there was this attraction for Chiang Mai because it's a variety of seasons here, and it's very attractive because it's got a lot of cosmopolitan type living, and you're away from the big city of Bangkok. And anybody in Thailand can actually echo this, which is there are major cities here and not a lot in between. So living here in the province of Chiang Mai, you can see that life can be quite westernized in terms of what you can get at the shop. But the attitudes of people are free and easy. This is not just to say that a person who can act stupid in public is accepted, so much as any person in public isn't questioned as to what they do, how they look, what they feel. There's no question before they actually appear. There's no question about how the person is in front of them. It's just, okay, why are you here? What did you want? And when you live here for a longer period, you see that you're not the only one that feels this non-conformity with a male-female environment. You realise at the very heart of culture here, there is a very grey area. Men look good. Women look androgynous. Women look very pretty. Some men look absolutely poor. They've walked into so many doors and walls, and they've been a manual worker for their whole life. They look, you know, poor appearance. But there's a wide variety of how people look, but it's how they feel. They feel free. From the young girls riding the motorbikes with the umbrella over the rider's head when it's raining, and she's sat side saddle, and it's sort of three lanes of traffic, and they're weaving in and out. That freedom, to the person who's walking along the street and not bumping into somebody else, because just like, and I'm rambling, but I wanted to tell you about this. If you drive a car in Thailand, you don't really feel as if you're going to hit somebody unless you've got a Western mind. If you walk in a major city hubbub area, like one of the main shopping malls here, you can walk in amongst people and you know you're not going to bump into somebody unless you've got a Western mind. Because in the West, you can walk along a pavement or drive along a road and you think that person in front of me is going to get out of the way because I've got the right of way. Because I'm going in this direction, they're not going to compromise where I am. But here in Thailand, it just blends. You weave, you walk past and through, and it's easy.
I'm going to stop you there because Thailand's fantastic, but we've got listeners who want to know about your relationship. What about Tuk?
Okay. In England, when I was trying to saturate myself with Thai-ness, I was going to a particular Thai restaurant in Woking because every Wednesday I would go for acupuncture for my tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Yeah, tinnitus. Ringing in the
tinnitus.
Ears.
Tinnitus.
Yeah.
Tinnitus.
Is that what it's called? Oh, I didn't have them.
Yeah, tinnitus. Tinnitus. And I was having acupuncture for it, and I'd go after acupuncture for a Thai meal. And this restaurant was quiet. I was the sole visitor there, and the waitress would attend to me and talk to me, and I'd ask questions, and I'd take a book along and read my book. Something interesting to read, not a Thai book, a language book, an interesting read. And I'd sit and read and eat and have a glass of something to drink. And this Thai waitress would almost sort of, make me feel, is there anything else I can do for you, is there anything I can get for you? And we'd have a bit of a conversation. And she spoke fairly good English. Well, this waitress's name was Puni. And she, funnily enough, hailed from about 4 or 5 kilometres from here. And she started to talk to me every time I went in there, and I felt there was this certain sort of acceptance of I could sit and chat, I could talk. Well, a couple of occasions I went in there, there was another waitress who also helped Puni, and it was Tuk. Now, Took is a pet name, if you like, that you call her. And when I asked this particular waitress her name, she says, "My name is Nataporn." And I said, "That's a long name. I can't really get my head around that."
I've been there.
"Do you mind if I call you Nat?" So I called her Nat. And we had a bit of a sort of an instant sort of eye to eye laugh, feel friendly towards each other. And within a week of having met her on, you know, customer and service provider basis, I felt I needed to know her more. I went back and back and back, and each time I'd hoped that she was there. And I grew this relationship into a month whereby I was seeing her every week and thinking, there's something here with this girl.
How long ago was this?
2003.
So this was a year after the the big moment,
yep,
when you had the genital reassignment. Yep. And at this point, you are engaging with talk on an emotional developing emotional and intimate way as a woman.
Yep.
She obviously saw you as a woman.
She did. She saw me as an attractive woman. She saw me as an immaculately dressed woman, stylish woman, somebody who was clean and sensitive. She saw me as somebody who could be respected and respectable. She saw me as a somebody who she could actually relate with. And it transpired that we both said to each other, "How did this happen? Why did we feel the way we did about each other?" But we kicked off very, very quickly purely on a conversation about what we were doing, who we'd seen, and what we wanted to do, and where we wanted to go.
Now, I've of course met Tuck, and she's a very attractive woman. She's in her 40s. She looks a lot younger.
Well, funnily enough, when I met her, I saw her with chopsticks in her hair, long jewellery, the formal dress. And when I met her 3 weeks later, first time outside of the restaurant, I saw her with a rucksack over her back, skinny jeans, and I thought, that's a 22-year-old. Have I done? But I've actually got somebody who's too young talking to me, and I'm not the right person to be talking to. This is wrong. And I said to my sister, I've got this relationship going with somebody I don't, you know, relationship, we've met her 4 or 5 times, and I don't know how old she is. Well, ask her, she said. I said, how do I do that? and when I asked her, she said, well, where are we now?
30-something.
Yeah, 30-something. She's 7 years my junior. My sister then, subsequently, who met her, she said, I don't believe you. And it's like you, Stephen. Mm. When you meet her, she has this... She has this chameleon look that she's either young or old, depending on how...
She's one of these women, Thai women, is quite sophisticated in her appearance.
She is.
She looks after herself, that's clear. And she looks young, because, you know, Thai women can start to look old. But you have a vagina.
Yep.
Why not get it filled by a penis? Because Tuck's not going to provide that, is she?
No. And to be quite honest, it's not always cracked up to be. Having had surgery back in 2002, I had a man's tongue inside me, and it was a very good, nice sensation, but it wasn't what I wanted. That was in 2003. In 2003 also, I had a man put his penis nearly in me.
Is that in the UK or here?
In the UK.
Okay.
He put his penis nearly in me, and I didn't really want to get any closer than it was nearly there.
Can I just stop there? Technicality. Does the, you know, when you make love with a woman, the vagina moisturises. Is your vagina able to do that, or do you need lubrication?
Oh, no. In some books and internet references, you'll find that the inside of the vagina can be made from the inside of the bowel, I think it is, or the intestine, where it's where the tissue secretes moisture.
Oh, okay.
Whereas if it's from within the with an inverted penis, as in my case, it can be dry as hell, and it's not very very comfortable, and it is dry, and it does not secrete its own moisture.
Okay.
And therefore, sorry, listeners, but on a daily basis, it's part of your health, regime, whereby you need to make sure that everything is clean, because there is not that moisture passing that a natural-born female passes.
Right.
But getting back to your question, since the age of 26, in the previous podcast, we talked about the relationship I had for 18 years with my wife, Teresa. We didn't have penetrative sex. And penetrative sex had never been something I ever enjoyed, let alone wanted. I have had penetrative sex, as in I was the male with my penis, and it was not something I really enjoyed. So therefore, what I really enjoyed and majored on and my sexual life with another person's being is to actually give and to provide and therefore to make the toes of a girl curl, to actually make the pleasure for the other person, not for my own purposes. And therefore, now, without a penis to satisfy somebody who might look for a penis, I don't have something there to provide. But what's more is, I'm not going to put myself into a relationship, and therefore have not, whereby a penis is part of the discussion. A penis is not part of the communication. A penis doesn't a penis isn't required.
It's not part of the expectation of the relationship, because it would be in a traditional, typical hetero relationship or gay relationship in that respect.
Mm.
So you and Tucker are now into a close relationship. You have a house. You're living together in a house not far from here in Chiang Mai, northern Thailand.
Her mother and father moved in with us. We've been here 7 years, so they moved in with us 5 years ago, and Dad died 2 years ago, bless him.
Sorry to hear that.
Mum lives with us still, and we have the whole family from all over Thailand coming to see Mum, stay with us for holidays and...
And the Tuck's family know about your past?
Totally.
They know everything?
Totally.
Everything
totally, from day one.
You're in love with Tuck?
I am in love. And when I...
If hopefully I can remember these categories that you gave to love. Wishful love? Soulmate love?
Exactly.
Because you've had at least one soulmate, I know that for sure.
And I only thought I'd get one.
You've been lucky.
I know. And the completeness of my giving is, I'm not saying it's what it's what's made it happen, but I only have the ability to have a relationship if I give total. And therefore, if I give total, I expect total as well. And therefore, these two soulmates that I would openly refer to them as, I have given, and they have given me total.
In the book Relationship Manifesto, I do stick with the term soulmate love, because I know some people, some writers think it's a bit cliched, but I don't think so. I think it's valid. I think soulmates come to us, and that's part of my Buddhist thinking. But there is something about the soulmate which is absolutely key that makes it a soulmate love. And that seems to me, Ali, with both Teresa and Tuck, they love and know who you are.
Yep.
There isn't any ambiguity. There's no confusion. They know who you are, and they love that person. They don't have to put a gender on it, or a sexuality, or an age, or a functional expectation that you will provide or not, whatever. They love who you are.
Totally right. And that's funnily enough echoed in the question I ask constantly. sorry if my voice falters, but it upsets me every time I say it. You know, why did you fall for me? Why did you choose me? Why me? And it's because the person you are that comes back, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not because of what you can give. It's not what you have.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, your convenience or, you know, I like. It is because of who you are, what you are inside you. And I respect that. And it's not something I like shout. It's not something I like to shout about, but it's really something that when you look in the mirror, you know. That's true.
It's the most important aspect of soulmate love, and it's the one thing that distinguishes it from the other types of love that I reveal and discuss and describe in my book. Soulmate love is that pureness. It's as if two souls have come together over the eons, over time, over past lives. You call it what you will. You can be as romantic about it as you like, but these two souls have a connection, and that connection comes through recognition. It's total and utter undiluted awareness of the other person. And in that moment, if you can have that in your life, then it is indeed a blessing. We have Ali here, who's had this now twice. Your long love, Teresa, in the UK, and now we took here in Thailand. Very different people, different cultures, different backgrounds, but this commonality that they connect with who you are.
Yeah.
And you are a complicated individual. You are as many aspects even now, even though you've been very frank and open and wonderfully revealing. There are many aspects of you that are still secret, mysterious. Just took know everything about you?
No. Because she only knows that I had sex before I met her.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't know I had sex before, in what ways I had it.
We've already agreed, listeners, that we're now on a borderline, and Ali and I have already agreed that we're not going to go here with this because Ali has no wish to, and obviously I'm going to respect Ali's wishes on that. We're not going to talk about this aspect of sexuality in the past.
At this point,
it might be something we'll come to in the future. So those of you now hanging on, wondering what comes next, are going to have to be patient. However, I'm not going to let Ali completely off the hook with this one because I'm very aware that some aspects of Ali's persona, her gender and sexual identity are very closely linked to power.
Yep.
And I would like Ali to tell us as much as she would like about the power and the dimensions of power and eroticism in her life.
Okay. When I was very much younger, about the age of 4, I realised that I enjoyed being the second person and being the submissive. And I think when I just spoke a while ago about the lack of penetration and the satisfaction of giving, I think that's all embroiled in there. But since the age of 4, I became totally obsessed with the sphere of what people generally term as M&S.
Listeners, just let me clarify.
That's you telling me, Marks and Spencer's earlier.
I'm sorry, we've got that.
Yes, the S&M. So,
listeners, we are talking 4 years old here.
Yeah.
Okay, that wasn't, you heard it right.
So from 4, I became aware that I wanted to be number 2. I didn't want to be alpha. I didn't want to be, you know, the top dog. And throughout my life, with a penis attached to me, I actually made a lot of play, or became totally obsessed with being submissive. During my period of 18 through to 26, I experimented with being gay, or I became bi, or I experimented with what I could do with men. I enjoyed power that I'd not witnessed until then. And I realised that I could actually do something to somebody, not have something done to me. I never, during that period, saw something that was shared. I always saw it as giving or taking.
In your case, you were giving or receiving.
So therefore, I never saw it as something that was blend, that was something that was joined, that something that was shared, that something that was...
not balanced.
Yeah. Oh. So 4 to 18, totally submissive. 18 to 26, a bit of each. 26 onwards, until I lost my penis. Totally submissive. Didn't enjoy any power, so much putting power, but totally enjoyed receiving and not being power. But that turns into the power and the strength and the confidence, and that is the lifeblood you felt at that time as to what kept you strong, because you're able to become that submissive person. And in my, I would say, important role in my work, I would stand up in front of 50, 100 people and talk to them about all sorts, and I had no problems whatsoever. I would do things with confidence and be able to talk very firmly and could become, as aggressive as needed in situations. But it, within me, I was obsessed with being number two.
Well, hang on a minute here, because you're working in a senior management position for a major corporation, in this instance, the British Airports Authority.
Yep.
As we said earlier, you're a suit.
Yep.
You're male, ostensibly.
Yep.
That's the performance you've got to give off as a senior manager.
Yep.
You're married. You've got four stepchildren.
Yep.
You're in your late 30s, 40s. And yet, allowing for all that outward persona of macho male management, Alan, inside, you're passive.
Yep.
You're not having penetrative sex with your wife.
Yep.
You're not having penetrative sex with anybody.
Yep.
Sexually, you're adopting a passive role. You still get, you must, I'm assuming you would, there was sexual pleasure and satisfaction between you and Teresa.
Yep.
So you're living this maleness, which appears on the outside to be stereotypically corporate man.
Yep.
You don't like being alpha man, but then again, you can stand up in front of 100 other managers, presumably, and give the spiel.
Yep.
With confidence.
Yep.
And conviction.
Yep.
And authenticity. But underneath that, there's this bubbling femininity, there's this passiveness, there's this man who wants to be fucked.
Nah. Maybe that wants to be fucked, but more likely that wants to just be nothing. Less than that. No importance at all.
Wants to be needed?
No.
Okay, we now move on to where we are today. You are a woman, legally, physically, emotionally, in a relationship with another woman, which does not include masculine sex, penetrative sex, but sexual pleasure and satisfaction on both parts.
Correct.
You are not in corporate world anymore. You're living out in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if I'm hearing this correctly, the Ali that's arisen out of the Alan is now feeling powerful.
Yep. I feel no subservience, no submission, no desire, wish, dream to have anything other than be joined, shared. But equally, I feel that if there is desire sexually, or if I want to identify my relationship with a male, it is that of power.
You see, one of the questions I had, and I'm not sure I can ask it now because it doesn't seem to fit. And anyway, help me with this, Ali. One of the questions I had, which has been on that my book, my notebook from the beginning, is I wanted you to take me through, or take us through, the differences between being a man and a woman. Because you are one of the very rare people, very special people, that's experienced both identities.
Yeah.
You've lived masculinity. You've talked about it with the BAA.
Yep.
You had to be the performing male.
Yep.
And convincingly, to be a senior manager in that situation. Now, you are convincingly the performing female. I know which you prefer, but can you explain the differences in terms of feelings or power? I don't know. I'm asking because I don't know really. I've only lived as a man.
If I can draw on some of the things that might be of recognisable to some women. And that is, or to some men who have heard women say this, it is what I see, which is the conversations that are totally geared around the male. The male has his life. The male has his way that he must receive whatever he receives in his daily activities and daily environment. And that the woman is not integrated but separate to and second to. That when I as a female are party to these two entities, I am seeing that the female is putting up with this male, and I'm seeing the male is actually not necessarily treating this female as openly, as equally as they could. And being on, not just because I can go into the toilet, any toilet, and I can choose to dress either way and nobody really care, that's a Thailand thing, but if you like, because I can go both ways, I can actually go to a group of men and experience being with those men. If they treat me as a male, I can experience how they're treating women. And I can go to a female group of people, and I can be appreciated for being female, and I can see how they're treating, putting up with, and if you like, trying to coexist with the male. And I have a bit of a giggle on both sides, because I can see that on some of the characters I've known in my life, the women are playing up to the male that the male actually wants them to play to. And I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing that for? Why can't you just be...
Isn't that part of being passive, though, for the female?
Yeah, that's true. But they're playing to it, and they're not realising that the males are getting off on this and really enjoying it. And it's then making it more difficult for the next female. But then you've got the male who's talking in one way to a female and talking in another way to a male, because they have disrespect for the female, or they have They don't know the words to use without getting caught up or without getting trapped or however the male feels about that discussion. And they're guarded about what they say. Sure, women do have this feeling of being on their guard about things too and needing to position themselves correctly in order that they can relate. But me, I can see them, the pair of them, and I can see marital relationships on both sides sometimes, and I think both of them need heads knocked together, and both of them are suffering from issues they need to come to terms with. And it's, for me, I don't see one side of it. I see both, as in identify what the issues are, and so often the man just needs a kick in the arse. And from hearing your previous podcasts about, you know, women have changed, have you, it's just so timely. The men just haven't got a clue about so many women issues, day-to-day things, living issues, family issues. They haven't got no clue whatsoever because they're on their own journey, they're on their own they're on their own way. And I know what, Stephen, you've said about Gray and whatever, but you know, this the basic thing that's mentioned in Gray, John Gray, is the two planets. You know, yeah, that's exactly right. You know, they come from a different perspective, but thankfully there's this journey happening by many men now, joining in the middle.
You see, and that's the key issue here, because what John Gray's suggesting, implicit in the idea that men are from Mars and women from Venus, is that never the twain shall meet, and there'll always be a confusion and garbling between the communication between these otherwise completely different species. I don't accept that. I think my position is, as you know from the podcast, is that this is a cultural gap.
Yep.
It's not a biological one. No. You know, men are not hardwired to be alpha males, emotionally distant, stoical.
It's all learned.
Yeah, absolutely. It's learned.
Yep.
So it can be, we've got a whole generation of women now coming through for a whole bunch of reasons that I've explored in the Relationship Manifesto, that they are challenging the old gender stereotypes of what it means to be a woman. That my mother, your mother, their grandmothers were brought up in and expected to follow and adhere to, and woe betide them if they changed or, you know, bucked the trend or social constraints. Women are different today. Men, some men are, some men aren't. But the fact that some men are is the good thing. That's the good news.
It's refreshing.
It's refreshing. The fact that not all men are, and many men are in retreat or actively resisting, is the problem. You are, I want to again make this idea that you're an artist in terms of your identity, what you've achieved and how you've gone about it, with the courage and the physical and emotional bravery that you've had to draw on and to find. All of us can do it to some extent, but it's not been easy. What have you learnt on this journey?
I wished I'd done it earlier. I wished I'd had the opportunity to know what I know now earlier in my life, whereby if I'd not been suppressed to conform, how today I might not be saying and feeling half of what I'm feeling, because, you know, I'd have made that journey so much earlier. And my current situation might not be as it is. I'd like to qualify that, because right now, if I was to get up this morning and not make an effort, I could actually walk out the door and people would say to me, I'm a man. If I make a little bit of effort, there's a question, am I a man or am I a woman? If I make a lot of effort, I can actually say that people don't know. And what I've learnt is, therefore, that I can do all of those three, but I don't need to. I've got a very forgiving partner. I live in a very forgiving, accepting, debate the word, environment in Thailand. And I can actually walk out the door and feel comfortable with who I am inside without actually needing to do anything on the outside. Because who's inside matters. And if I now get up in the morning and walk out, I don't have to care what I put on, what I look like. I don't have to care. I do, out of respect for my other half, or, you know, I don't want her to look pretty and me not look nice. I don't want for me to be looking nasty. But I can actually feel comfortable. And where I am now, and this isn't video, sadly, but, you know, I can turn out, you know, quite a sort of a masculine looking person on the outside, and I'm quite comfortable with that. I couldn't do that. 2002. I couldn't do that. I couldn't become. I couldn't remain at that point because of the conformity. I'm now okay.
I've got one last question I want to put to you, because not everybody who's listening to this, who finds themselves maybe in a similar situation to you, in a young person, man or woman, they're not all living in Thailand. They're not all living in such a possibly accepting environment. You've come from the unaccepting into the accepting. Imagine you've got a young person out there who's about to embark on a similar journey to you, and there are people out there right now doing this. What do you say to them?
Do it. But research it. Go somewhere like Thailand and understand the basic differences of life. Not how it makes you feel sexually, or how your mother and father or your brother and sister would feel about it. Feel how you feel in Thailand with the difference of approach to you, the difference of I use this word acceptance, but it's wrong. The difference that you can just not need to conform, the difference that you can be you, and then know for sure that when you make your transition, you're actually making it to be the person you are. And back in the UK, if you didn't have the breasts to make your size proportionate, if you didn't, you know, successfully remove the stubble from your chin and remove the forehead sticking over your eyes that so many men have to have removed, if you don't go through with that, it doesn't matter. It's what's inside matters. And if you can maintain a level of relationship with people, and that's not just a person who you can have a relationship loving, caring with, but with people per se, you know, you walk into somebody and say, hello, I'd like this, and hello, I'd like you to do this, and I'd like you to work with this for me, and that sort of thing. If you can maintain a fairly stable relationship with people in that way, then you know you're able to do this. However, if you've got to put all the trappings of a glossy magazine over your head in order to convince the masculine society that you live within that it's right to do all you're doing, then maybe you're not in the right environment to make that decision.
Ali, this has been the most fantastic podcast, three of them. I personally like to thank you so very much for sharing all this with us. It's been a learning curve for both Chris and I. Been wonderful.
I'm going to come in with another final question, though. I think you've just answered the question I was going to ask. I'm going to put you in a time machine, mm-hmm. and you're going to go back, and you're going to be stood next to that 19-year-old lad mm-hmm. that was in the vegetable shop when Mrs. Robinson walked in the door.
Yeah.
What would you say to him?
I think, Chris, what I'd say to him, rolling back those years, is you've left it too late to change how you feel, because you're entrenched on those rails. You're on those rails from a very early age. But be aware you can now make, you know, you can branch out at the next junction. Just identify that junction earlier. And therefore, rather than staying on those rails forever and ever and ever, you can actually jump.
Yes.
And therefore, be aware of them. You can't change what's gone before, and you'll have to live with that. So just become more aware and open to the fact that you can make a change.
And maybe come to Thailand sooner rather than later.
You know, I'd give him a phone number and email to actually help you out, but I think that's inappropriate. But Stephen's right. You know, just see the difference here. And I don't think it's isolated to one spot or one type of people here. It's inbred in the environment. Totally different.
Well, that brings us to the end of the trilogy. The roller coaster is coming to the station now. We can get off. Right, I'm also appreciative of you being so open and willing to share. For me, I think what's encouraging is I think some listeners, as with our earlier podcasts, it's you know, from the feedback we've had, it's been very beneficial to those people. And so thanks very much. If you want to leave any comments, or you want to see or listen to other podcasts, go back to the podcast blog that we have, relationshipmanifesto.posterous.com, and you can see the previous ones there, and leave comments if you want to.
Okay, I'd like to just say one final note. Death and bereavement are a massive blow, especially when you have a soulmate. And somebody 2 years ago said to me, I've just lost my wife, and I'm so close to her, and I don't know what's happening to me. And I said, well, I can share some of your feeling, but I said, it will change you. You will become a different person, and it will make you stronger. But what's more is, it will remove any inhibition you previously had about doing certain things. And I think without the death of Teresa, I don't think the stick of dynamite would have been up my arse. I don't think there would have been a catalyst to have actually driven myself to a psychiatrist. I don't think what I am feel today would have happened if there had not been a death at that point. So death in a soulmate scenario. You're saying last time, previous time, I've listened to the podcast out of order. So the last one I listened to was where Stephen said, you know, soulmates, you know, you sometimes get a chance of more than one. That's very true. But the thing that left me when listening to that was that there's a big issue that happens just as you leave that.
Mm.
Lose that one, devastating. You might be lucky to have another, but you've got to get through that period, which is so very, very difficult, because you've lost your lifeblood, you've lost everything. And it can actually make or break people.
Stephen, Ali, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, catch you next week. Have fun.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.